This episode and the entire season is proudly brought to you by California Cryobank. Use code QueerFam26 for a free level 3 subscription to their donor catalog. Make those babies and then come tell me about them. Ha ha.
The Queer Family Podcast. Love is love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
And we had our first kiss at 8 in the evening and our first dinner at 9 in the evening. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, Hannah said, you know, when London closes down, it's certainly not a 24-hour city like New York is. And Hannah said, you know, there's this place I can take us to. And we walked into this private military bar that I never knew was even there in London. They saluted her as she walked in. I was kid is the coolest woman.
Oh, my God.
I was just like, hooked.
Welcome, 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 y'all, to the Queer Family Podcast, the show all about family, but with gay. I'm Jamie, your gay host, and this is the show that celebrates, highlights, uplifts, and normalizes LGBTQIA families in all of our fabulous identities. And I have a very special friend with me to be my co-host.
Hello, hello. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. It is Jose Rolon, a.k.a. NYC Gay Dad, a.k.a. my co-host on our other show, Love Take Two, which if you haven't listened to that yet, you got to go over there and listen. Even if you don't listen, just subscribe, please, because it helps us.
Yes.
But yeah, Jose's back to help me with this here episode. And it's a really good one, right, Jose?
It's amazing. Yeah, I was blown away, like inspired.
Such a good story. So we had the pleasure of sitting down with Jake and Hannah. They live across the pond, I like to call it, in the UK. And they are amazing, amazing, amazing people. They're a married couple. They are both trans. They have two beautiful children. They want more. And their story towards parenthood.
Which I thought was insane.
Because you have
three. As a parent of three. Sorry.
You didn't say that to them, though. You were like, I think you should do it.
I don't know. I think I did give them a quick little warning. We'll have to roll the tape and see, but yeah.
You did. You give them a quick little warning, but then you're also saying it is rewarding. But we love our kids. We really do, y'all. But it's a really wonderful episode, and their journey to parenthood is beautiful, and just their whole story. I really adore these two. They also have a children's book that I think is now finally out. It's called The Silly Frilly Dress. And I think we all need to put this book on our shelves for our children. Don't you think, Jose?
I mean, by the way, those are things that I wanted to wear that I was not allowed to wear. Yeah, you know, I don't think I ever told this story, but like, I remember being in kindergarten and being sent home because I decided to wear a dress.
Oh my God, really? So your parents sent you to school in a dress, or they didn't know you were wearing it?
No, you know how they have like the corner room with all the dresses and dress up stuff? I put on a wedding dress. And naturally.
Naturally.
And that was the last day I saw that daycare.
Oh my awful. God. That's so sad.
I know.
Oh,
but if they and maybe my parents had the silly frilly dress, I'd probably still have friends from that daycare.
Aw, did you get in trouble when you got home?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Oh, totally. I'm sorry. We're raising our kids differently.
Still gay.
You're still gay, and you're proud.
And I wear dresses. I will wear a dress.
Yeah, I know you will, and a wig. But this book is about a little girl who doesn't want to wear a silly frilly dress, and all about how she feels. And I haven't read the book, but it looks like a really great book for, like, you have a daughter who doesn't like to wear dresses. I had a daughter who refused to wear dresses until puberty, and now all of a sudden there's dresses galore. I don't even understand, but anyway.
I bet my daughter Lila will never want to wear a dress.
I can see that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
once she hit three, it was a wrap.
And I'm all about it for her. I love that. I love all. Yeah. I love all three of your children, and I really, really love Lila a lot. She's amazing. I love them all.
She's a hit within our community. You know what I'm saying?
She fits in. This is a really great episode. Y'all are going to love it. And I'm super excited to share it with you. And Jose is with us the whole time, and the insights that you give. See, what I say all the time about the two of us as co-hosts, Jose, since we've been doing it for some time, you come in with the heart. You come in with like the heartfelt thing that needed to be said and giving love and kudos to people. And I come in with a dumb joke.
No, you don't. You come in with, no, you don't. Actually, I think we both come in with the jokes. You come in with a lot of insight. You're very thoughtful and you have, you just have a way to articulate things in a way that I certainly can't. And I don't know. I think you come in with the stuff that, yeah, I may be the heart, but you come in with, like, you know, the stuff that, I don't know, needs to be said also.
Look at us loving on each other. You're like the relatable, heartfelt. Yeah. And you're relatable and it's heartfelt when you say the things. And so anyway, all that being said, this is great. We had a great conversation with Jake and Hannah. I love them to death. And they might have a third child coming soon. I don't know. Oh, people come on my show and I make babies. That's what I do.
I love it.
All right. Well, okay. Let's go ahead and roll this tape. Helen Beulah, can you come in here, please, and roll this tape? You know I have fake assistants, right?
I didn't, but now I know. That's fantastic.
Yeah, Helen and Beulah, they don't have much hair. They're old. They smoke cigarettes all day. They drink whiskey. They sit on my couch. And their only job is to hit the button to roll the tape. That's it. And then they mess that up, too. Oh, my God. They're a mess.
By the way, you say people come in here and end up having babies. I'm being very clear with you because I've been on this like 3-4 times. I do not want 4 kids.
Let's see if we can make that happen for you. All right. I'll send Helen and Beulah over. They'll help you out. Good luck with that. All right, Helen, Beulah, let's roll this tape. Let's go.
Queer Family Podcast, love is love.
Hi, Jake and Hannah.
Hi, Jamie. How are you doing today?
We have Jose here as well, NYC gay dad, who is helping me chat with you and was super excited to meet you as well.
Yeah, this is fantastic.
Hey, Jose.
Hello. Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for joining. I'm super excited. I've been stalking you a little bit on social media, learning about the two of you, and I can't wait to get into it. So without further ado, we would love to hear your 30-second elevator pitch, Jake and Hannah, of who you are and why you're here talking to the Queer Family Podcast. Let's do 30 seconds each. Who wants to go first?
Jake does.
Apparently I do.
All right. Ready, set, go for it. Go for it.
So my name is Jake Graff, and I am a filmmaker, author, and director based in London. About 10 years ago, I decided that as a trans man, I really wanted to become a parent. And so I stopped testosterone for 6 months and had some eggs harvested and fertilized and ended up with 5 little embryos on ice. And they just kind of sat quietly there until I met my beautiful wife, Hannah. We then got married and found a fantastic surrogate who gave birth to not one, but 2 beautiful babies, Millie and Teddy. And that's why we're here.
Boom. Oh my God. You did it in 30 seconds.
That was solid.
Hannah, I don't know. Competition's fierce for you right now. Okay.
I am super competitive, but I know that Jake is much better at this kind of stuff than me. No. I'll do my best.
Hannah, you got this. You got this. And I'm so excited for your story. Okay. Ready, Hannah? Set. Go for it.
Hello. I am Hannah Graff. I am a military veteran. I was an officer in the British Army for a decade. I am a trans woman. And when I transitioned, I thought I was giving up the chance to be ever in love or have a relationship, let alone start a family. So when I first started dating Jake, and Jake said to me that he really wanted a family, it was a bit of a curveball. But ultimately, that's where I ended up. And I now have 2 beautiful daughters that I'm very, very proud to be a family with.
Beautiful. Beautifully done, both of you. It's like you rehearsed it. And this is really, really exciting. So we need to dig right in. So Jake, it sounds like before you even knew Hannah, you decided you were going to create the embryos. So you went off test. How was it going off testosterone first, can I ask?
Honestly, you know, people, friends of mine said, oh my God, you're going to be suicidal. You're going to be so depressed. You know, everyone was really worried about me. Like I needed to be on some sort of watch. Honestly, by 6 years into testosterone use, I was happy in myself. I knew I was the man I'd always meant to be. I was always meant to be. You know, I was confident, and much as it was a difficult process, my muscle dropped, my emotions, you know, rocketed to the surface. I was crying at every like commercial on television. Everything made me cry. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, testosterone kind of really does. It is true what they say, boys don't cry. Testosterone does really kind of block up those tear ducts. And, you know, sometimes I'd love to be able to cry when I'm not able to. So for those sort of 6 months when I was off it, I was just, you know, welling up at everything, which was great. Releasing all those toxins and, you know, negativity. I knew what the end goal was. It wasn't particularly pleasant. I went to a place called the London Women's Clinic in London. The first time I went with my mum, who was like, I'm going to support you. And as we arrived, walked in together to this changing room, waiting room, it kind of looked to everyone, I think, like I was her younger toy boy and we were a couple trying to get, you know, get pregnant together.
Oh my gosh.
So that was the last time we did that. Yeah. And then I waited quietly in a corridor and that was fine. And I went and I did my thing. And after, you know, 6 months of sort of letting everything wash out of my system, I had the egg harvesting, which again, is not particularly pleasant. It's not something I'd want to repeat, but again, end in sight. And when I got 19 eggs, they were like, wow, 19 eggs, how incredibly viable. I was like, sweet. And then they said, you know, what you should really do is have them fertilized because then your chances of it becoming a good pregnancy, I think doubled or something from like 20% to about 40 or 50. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. You know, I went through a book. There were lots of lovely sperm donors, no photos, but lots of, you know, tall, handsome, I want to do it because of this. I'm an engineer. And I happened to choose someone who was a tall, brown-eyed engineer, which is basically Hannah, tall, brown-eyed engineer, purely by chance.
Yeah. How crazy is that?
And I think obviously kismet, right?
Yeah.
And so we got out of those. I had 5 really healthy embryos that went to 5-day blastocyst. And that was that. That was, you know, the whole process in a painful 6-month nutshell, which, you know, really was worth every single moment.
Wow. Wow. This is amazing. And the donor that you picked out, was that through the British system? I can't think of what it's called.
It was called the London Sperm Bank.
Oh,
so
okay.
You know, no mincing words. it literally was, you know, what it said. And I paid £1,000 for a sample, and luckily, yeah, you know, the motility was good. And, you know, as I say, you sit and you wait for those 5 days. I'm sure you're familiar. And then, you know, things happen. And some, obviously, as you see some kind of falling away, it's a little bit heartbreaking. But essentially, 5, everyone went, wow. I was like, oh my God, only 5. And all my friends were like, 5? That is amazing, especially after 6 years of washing my body with testosterone and so on. You know, I think the clinic was kind of amazed, actually, how viable it all still was.
That is amazing. And it's a big important thing that I've learned doing this show in the over 200 episodes that I've done, that testosterone does not necessarily have negative effects on your fertility, which the whole world needs to know about. Like we need to scream this from the rooftops, and because people have their own weird theories about all the stuff, right? But yeah, sorry, Jose, go ahead.
No, I would love you to respond to that. Actually, I find that really fascinating.
You know, this is the thing with the younger generation these days. It's all now. You know, Hannah and I didn't transition respectively until we were both in our mid-20s. And, you know, the younger generation at sort of 12 and 13, they're thinking about, you know, I want my phalloplasty. I want my hysterectomy. I want. Yeah. We're like, guys, calm down. Take your time. You know, as far as I know from my experience, most of the trans guys I've met a little bit later on really want kids. You know, I don't know, again, if that's a sort of maternal biological throwback. I would say more of the trans women I know tend not to necessarily want kids. But again, that is just a generalization because, mm-hmm. you know, Hannah is the best mom you could possibly be. But, you know, these young people who are so absolutely adamant that they have to do everything now. And, you know, we know that hormone blockers are not irreversible, and the whole myth is they're irreversible, you're damaging these children, they end up infertile, blah blah, which is not true. And obviously, you know, when you have cross-sex hormones, the thing that it is important to say, which we always say to these young people, is that if you go straight from the blockers onto the cross-sex hormones, and if these young guys are going straight onto testosterone and not having their sort of natal puberty, then obviously that can affect fertility later in life. We'd always kind of say, you know what, give yourself the time, think through everything. And I know that when, you know, you're 14 or 15 or going through your puberty, you're not thinking one day I might want to be a parent or a dad, right, or even carry your child. Of course, you're not thinking about that at that point. Mm. We always say to the younger people, give yourself the opportunity in the future, because, you know, Hannah, I don't know if you want to share your...
Well, I think it's just about informed choices, right? Because as I said in my little, blurbed intro, is that when I transitioned, growing up, you know, in the late 90s and in the early 2000s in the UK, as I'm sure it's the same in the US, you're taught to hate yourself, right? You're taught that trans women are disgusting, you're unlovable, you're a freak, you're a weirdo. Like, and it's hard not to live in that environment for years and years and years without internalizing some of that. Mm-hmm. So when I transitioned, I was generally thinking, well, I'll be alone, but that's okay because I'll be myself and that's enough. And that's all I wanted when I was like 23, was just to be me. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, once you then transition and you live your life and you live your reality, and then you realize actually those things are available to me. You meet people and you realize actually maybe you can be loved, etc. And so your mind is opened. But at the stage when I was transitioning, why even think about doing anything about having a family when I'm going to be alone for the rest of life? And that's honestly how I thought, as sad as that is in hindsight. And so I didn't have those. I didn't make any sort of preparations for having a family, which, again, I agree with Jake in saying it is, I would always advise to stop and think about it. But to anyone who is in that position, either when they consciously thought about it and didn't decide to, or didn't think about it, there are different ways to become a family. And I am one example of that. And having your own biological kids is a very amazing experience, I am sure. But I'll tell you now that my experience of having kids that are not biologically mine is equally amazing.
100%. And I think Jose can relate to that. I can relate to that because I'm a bio mom to one of them and a non-bio mom to one of them. And Jose, you have a similar same, right?
Yeah. I mean, my son, who is 13, is not biologically mine. And I remember when he was first born, I thought, I had him with my late husband, and my first reaction when he was born, when he came out looking white and blonde, I was like, damn it. And I struggled. I struggled there for a little bit, but then something happened 2 months in that it just changed everything. And I think people would tell you now, when they see me with my three kids, they can see that I have probably the more special relationship with my son than my two daughters who are biologically mine. And yeah, I mean, it really just hit the, just proves it that it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
I didn't even think about it.
I was going to say, I think the only thing for me, and I think how it matters, I think for trans people, is realistically, given the climate globally at the moment, I think there are very, very few people, unless you've got a partner who's you're doing that as a partnership with. I think, in terms of adoption, I don't think trans people at the moment are going to be first in line for adoption or fostering. So I think our options are very limited. That's how I saw it. I thought no one is ever going to give a single trans guy, which is what I was at the time, a child. And for me, the only way I saw of ever having a child was if it came of me. So that's kind of what I did. And because it was, I was single, I just thought, one day I'll meet a girl who will carry our baby. And that was that. And then obviously I met Hannah, and that was added spanner in the works. But,
amazing.
We got there, our surrogate is this amazing woman, a pediatric nurse based in Belfast. And she actually messaged us. She got in touch with us over social media, Facebook, and said, I know you're looking and I know it's been tough and I would love to help you, because we were coming up across all the doors. We time after time we were getting leapt over because, again, no one wanted to work with a trans couple. No one wanted to help a trans couple become a family. And this woman was like, your story is fantastic and I would love to help you become a family. And we will forever, of course, be grateful to this fantastic woman who helped us have our two little babies.
I think surrogates are such a blessing. We loved ours. And I actually really appreciate you bringing up the point about adoption, because, I think I'm fortunate to live in a community where there's plenty of other gay dads that that I connect with. And a lot of them have gone through adoption, and still, even in 2026, when it comes to adoption, gay men are at the end of that line. And the options are very limited. So forget about when you're thinking about the trans community, it's like, you're not even in line.
Yeah,
that is exactly right. And I think that for me was why I just, I went through something that I could never have carried a child. The thought leaves me absolutely cold. I really admire guys who do. I cannot imagine those changes happening to my body. You know, puberty was bad enough. That I would imagine would be equally, or if not more, distressing to a man who wasn't happy, that, you know, the dysphoria for me. So, you know, from my point of view, it was never to carry. It was always just to give myself that chance, should I meet the right person in the future. And, you know, as I say, thank goodness, here we are, you know, and our two little babies are in bed next door, having driven us mad all evening.
That's their job.
Joy. Absolute
yes.
joy.
Well, we haven't talked about you two meeting. I want to hear the story. And then I want to hear the story of how we've gotten little snippets of the surrogate, but I want to hear how it all came to be. And Hannah, I'd love to hear your perspective on being gifted embryos and like a whole, I want to hear the whole thing. So let's go into your origin story of the two of you.
How did we meet? Jake messaged me on Facebook, basically. That was how we met. I'd come out as trans in the British Army. I'd sort of done about 6 months post-transition, and I was kind of, you know, getting... No, it was maybe it was longer than that. I can't remember. It was so long ago now.
Hannah, what was it like coming out as trans in the Army? I mean, that couldn't have been easy.
I mean, it was still definitely scary.
Yes.
But actually, I had a really positive experience. I mean, I think Jake and I both were sort of in the public eye in the trans world in the UK, right at the sort of like peak of trans acceptance. Like it was when things were really going well, but before the backlash really started. So it was a good time to come out.
It was like a year, wasn't it? A year where we weren't being persecuted in 2015.
And we're just, like, wow,
do we hold on to that?
Right? Like, it was that time. It was the time. It was the best of times.
But it was. Yeah. It was Laverne Cox on the cover of Time. Yeah. It was. And obviously now we don't really say her name, but the lady who came out on the cover of Vanity Fair, who we thought, you know, our great white hope, this is going to be fantastic. And obviously, you know, we know how that turned out. But, you know, there was a moment there when things were looking great. And that was when we sort of met, when you came out.
Yeah, I mean, I always try and say that, I mean, people have really stereotypical views of what the Army is like. You know, it's macho, male dominated. And yes, some of that's true, but it sort of covers up like the truth, which is actually there's a lot of really good people who work in the Army who are very like servants and want to serve their country and, you know, be part of a team and be something big, you know, part of something special. And the best example I always give is that, like, I've been to Afghanistan. Anyone who's been in the military is either trained for or been in a position where you are fighting for your life. And in that moment, you don't care if the person next to you is trans or gay or black or Muslim or Jewish or anything else you care about. Can they shoot straight? Can they run fast? And if needs be, they're going to carry me home to my family. And that point of reference really allows people to value people for what they can do rather than who they innately are. So actually, I just made sure I was still good at my job and people respected me for that. So actually, it was a really positive experience.
That's amazing. God, we need more stories like that. We need this whole story, this whole thing, and all the stories that are told on this show, I feel like they need to be blasted. Like, they should be the majority of what we hear in media, our stories. This is what needs to happen to make this world a more empathetic and loving place. Like, come on. Ugh.
Unfortunately, that would jar with the entire media propaganda campaign, you know, normal, I don't even like using the word normal, but they're usual, ordinary people living lives, living inspiring lives in some cases. I mean, you know, how on earth would that go down? That wouldn't like sell newspapers. No one would be interested in that. Happy stories.
There's no scandals. Like, we're sadly boring.
I know.
It's so true.
I know, right?
I want to get back to that Facebook message. And what year is this?
2015.
Yeah. Slid into those DMs.
So I'd come out in the Army and then someone had leaked my story. And so I was outed on the front page of the national newspaper here in the UK.
It's pretty bad.
That had catapulted me into the public sphere. And although it was a very scary, not something I asked for, it suddenly gave me a platform to talk. And I was determined to use that platform and voice to talk about a public, you know, positive experience about being trans in the Army. And so that's what I was doing. And I was starting to do sort of public speaking around the place to try and use that voice. And at the same time, Jake, in his own right, was doing amazing things. He'd just been in The Danish Girl, the film with Eddie Redmayne. And you were doing the sort of the press tour for that, again, talking about trans inclusion. So we were both kind of doing our own separate things within the same sphere. And so Jake saw me on Facebook and thought you'd slide into my DMs.
No, that's not at all what happened. What happened was, actually, if you want to be candid about this, I saw her pop up on my People You May Know. And obviously the trans community is very, very small. And I'd seen her and I thought, okay, why not? popped a little, you know, pressed a button. This one slid straight into the DMs with a, "Oh, Jake, I've been following your exploits with so much interest. I think it's fantastic what you're doing. I'd love to go for a drink." Hannah, what? Kiss, kiss, kiss. So I thought, wow.
Now imagine that in my voice. "Hey, Jake, you know, you do what you do is really great. I'd love to go for a drink with you."
Kiss,
he was
kiss,
just
kiss.
So eager, honestly. I just felt like I had to just, you know. So anyway, we started talking and it was the most mortifying
Facebook flirtation.
Oh. I mean, any kind of flirtation was so bad. She was going on about spiders being caught in her web, nonsensical, just utter rubbish. When we look back on it, we're like, oh my God, how do we even end up together?
In Facebook, you can scroll all the way back.
You can find it.
It's still there, in memoriam.
It's still sitting there. And then after about a week of talking to this girl, I was like, "Can we meet for a drink?" And she said, "No, first I'd like to do a Skype," which dates
now it. Now everyone does like video calls.
And I said, "What do you mean a Skype? Why can't we just get on the phone?" And obviously she was worried about her voice being slightly deeper, that when I heard her, I wouldn't. But obviously I'd seen her being interviewed. I knew who she was, and that wasn't an issue. So when we had our very first phone conversation, I did say to her within about 5 minutes, I was like, "Look, I'm not going to waste your time here. I really want marriage and kids. So if this is not what you want, then let's just move on." And I have to say, to Hannah's credit, she did not run screaming. She did sort of nervously say, "Well, I mean, I've never really thought about that before, man who I have never met. But, you know, I might possibly, were we to talk about it and meet and actually get on, think about marriage and kids." And we, you know, we had this first date that lasted 11 hours. And just for the first time in our lives, first time in my life, Hannah had never dated before me. So I kind of like had this, you know, blank canvas.
First date.
Yeah. Luckily, no point of reference whatsoever.
Yeah.
So when I said to her, "Let's meet at 3 o'clock in the afternoon," she thought it was totally normal. I thought, if it's really bad by six, I can just go out and see my friends. It was Christmas time. You know, I got the emergency call. But literally the first moment I saw her standing in Waterloo Station in the middle of London, I thought, what a beautiful woman. And she looked shy and she looked nervous and she was just beautiful. And I felt a real pull. And we went and just walked along the South Bank in London by the river and talked about everything from life, love, music. You know, we're both into metal, and which is quite unusual, and just clicked. And for once in our lives, once in my life, we didn't talk about trans anything, dysphoria or hormones or my transition or how are we going to tell our parents. None of that. It was just normality, and I hate using normality. It was an ordinary, I would imagine, date. And we had our first kiss at 8 in the evening and our first dinner at 9 in the evening. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, Hannah said, you know, when London closes down, it's certainly not a 24-hour city like New York is. And Hannah said, you know, there's this place I can take us to. And we walked into this private military bar that I never knew was even there in London. They saluted her as she walked in. I was kid is the coolest woman.
Oh, my God.
I was just like hooked.
Oh,
and
my God.
The next day was 31st of December. And I actually left my friends early. Bought her the first bunch of flowers she'd ever been bought. And we toasted in the new year with Prosecco. And I used the very cool line, "Would you like to come back to my flat and see my films?" And she was in, and that was it. Reeled her in. And
I have two things here. Yeah, the rest was history. Two things here. First of all, that whole story is so lesbian.
Thank you.
I mean, and amazing.
I was a lesbian for 15 years. So,
there you
know,
go.
I've got my stripes.
You got your stripes. And my first date was very much like that. It just kept going and going. It never ended. And also, you brought something up in the beginning of the telling of this story about how you basically brought up making babies on your right away, like before the first date, actually. And that's a theme that comes up time and time again on this show because of the nature of the way our bodies work together. There are a lot of details that need to be figured out. It's not just that conversation that I imagine the non-queers have, like, "Do you want kids? Yeah. Do you? Great. Okay. We'll talk about that later someday." No. It's, "Do you want kids? Yes. Do you want kids? Okay. How do you think we should go about doing it? What kind of donor would we have? What kind of, would we do adoption? Would we do like, there are so many things to hash out. So those conversations usually end up happening so very soon in our relationships, which is what makes us super intentional and the best parents there are, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I mean, statistically. But I think at the time also, there was a 5 or 10 year limit on how long you could have embryos on ice, which obviously was in the back of my mind all the time. Like, my God, this finite. Now they've extended that to 50 years. So as it turns out, I could have been much more relaxed about the whole thing. But at the time I was like, okay, we've got 5 years here. Let's get on with this. Okay. It was meant to be. And, you know, honestly, I can't imagine having a better mother for our little girls.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's very kind.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love the whole story of the two of you. It is so special and so sweet. We'll be right back.
Queer Family Podcast, love is love.
Well, speaking of donors and everything that goes into queer family building, I have a promo code for you. It is with California Cryobank, and it's going to give you a free level 3 subscription to their donor catalog. So you can start making that family if you are in the mood to do so. You're going to use code QUEERFAM26, that's QUEERFAM26, to get a free level 3 subscription to their donor catalog. You're going to go take a look and see if there's a donor that's right for you. For nearly 50 years, y'all, California Cryobank has proudly helped the LGBTQIA+ community create their families and fulfill their dreams of parenthood. They are the number one sperm bank in the U.S., and they ship to all 50 states and over 40 countries. They have a great, diverse selection of donors. They offer amazing, amazing things for the LGBTQIA community that are really thought through and tailored to us, like letters for second parent adoption. I use California Cryobank. I love them. And if you're ready to start that baby-making journey, it doesn't hurt to go check them out. So head to cryobank.com, use code QUEERFAM26, and check out that level 3 donor catalog subscription. Go make those babies, y'all, and then come tell me about them. All right, back to the episode.
Love is love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
Hi, Deani. Oh my God, you are never going to believe what my wife said to me the other day. I cannot
wait. Jamie. Save it for the Patreon.
What? Oh, right. Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. Okay. Listen, everyone at home, if you want to hear what my wife said, plus a lot of other things that I have been dying to get off my chest, and there are some things, y'all, there really are, you need to come join us on our Patreon.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's me and my good friend Deani here, the amazing millennial who is young and sprightly, spilling all the tea in our queer little lives and exclusive contents that you literally cannot find anywhere else, literally nowhere else in the world.
The link is in the bio. Come be part of the queer family.
Love is love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love. Love is love.
So you basically U-hauled, as any self-respecting lesbian would. And then what happened next? Like, how soon after did you start really working towards the baby making?
It's important to remember that Hannah was still in the army for the first 2 years of our relationship. So she was stationed way up north. So we were a weekend relationship for the best part of 2 years.
Wow.
And Hannah would come down to London to see me. And, you know, at first it was fine and I quite liked having that week of nothing, but then it became harder and harder. Every Sunday she'd cry and then we'd both cry. And it, you know, I started sort of saying, look, you know, I don't want a military life. I'd never wanted, you know, I knew so little about the army until I met Hannah. And, you know, obviously I have massive respect and I learned so much about some of the fantastic stuff they do, but I had never wanted to be a nomad. And that's effectively what a lot of her friends are, you know, this nomadic lifestyle of, you know, just sort of hopping. Oh, you know, he's gone here and he's going to have 2 years there and he's now gone to America. And after about 18 months, Hannah said, well, there's a posting coming up in Canada and I'll have to be gone for, I think it was 3 months, but that was 3 months. And I said, oh, don't worry, I'll come and visit you and we can FaceTime. She said, no, we will be out there as though we were at war. And this is the training that we have to do before I can make major. And there will be no visits, there will be no phone calls, there will be it's just not. And I thought, do you know what? This was the sort of the beginning of, I thought I could just see that being our lives of, you know, long distance. And it's not what I wanted. And so I kind of gave Hannah an ultimatum and thank God it didn't all blow up in my face.
Yeah.
And Hannah, what was that moment like for you?
It wasn't easy. Like I signed up to join the army when I was 15.
Wow.
And I went to a military school to do my A-levels. I'm not sure what the equivalent is in the US, but, you know, just the sort of the last ones you do before you go to college or university. So I did 2 years in a military school. And then I went through, went to university or college supported by the military. Then I was in Santa. So, and then I was like serving. So it had been like a goal of mine and my trajectory from a really young age.
Yeah.
And I had set expectations for myself in the military about what I wanted to achieve. And this was really crashing against that. So it wasn't the easiest thing to do, but I also knew that what we had was really special. And again, I had in the back of my mind as well, so as a trans person, you know, I don't know how many chances you get at love and life. So it was a difficult decision to make and one I didn't make lightly, but ultimately I said that I would do it and I would leave the military to try and start a family with Jake. My one condition was that I wanted to, my goal was to get promoted to major. And so I found out that I had made the cut to be promoted to major, and I gave him my notice the very next day. So that was like, it wasn't quite what I wanted, never actually became a major, but I proved myself that I would have been. And so it was a bit of a little bit of compromise on your side in terms of time. But I don't regret it, and I miss the army, and I love the people still, and I look back on the time really fondly, but I don't regret it because here I am now with, you know, an amazing family, and I don't think that would have happened otherwise.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, I'm a son of a Marine and, you know, and yeah, I mean, the bonds and the special relationships that happen in military is just unlike anything that really exists out there. And so, yeah, I imagine that must have been a really difficult decision, but obviously one that was worth it.
Yeah. And so my best friends in life still remain those people I joined the military with. And like I said, it's just a shared experience that you just can't get elsewhere. And again, I have a very boring job in finance now, and
she's an anti-financial crime. She's fighting bad people who are doing all sorts of terrible things. You're fantastic.
Okay, but like from a corporate perspective, it's still like going into a corporate office 9 to 5 sort of thing. And so it's a shadow of my, you know, exciting life in the military in many
fighting
ways.
Fighting crime. Fighting literally, she's like crime. Superman or Batman, you know, whatever.
I could see how it's the same, but different a little bit, maybe sort of very different.
Maybe share some of the same purpose, but I'm not flying the world jumping out of planes, put it that way.
No, but you have the memories. But that's a big change. And that's, a family comes with sacrifice. That's something that is universal to family and kids. And the amount
I guess
of
it goes back to what you're saying about being intentional about it, right? Which is that, you know, people who aren't queer can just go about their lives and what happens. Whereas I knew that if I wanted a family, I had to think about what did I need to do now, the steps I had to take. And this was a path that led to having a family. And here's what Jake wanted. I didn't come into this going, I really, really want a family. It was something that sort of happened to me a little bit and my experience evolved over time. But, you know, by the time we were having this conversation, you know, we've been together for years and I was like, yeah, that is something I want. And so it's like, well, if that's something I want, this is the step I need to take, regardless of those other, you know, sacrifices I might need to make.
Intentionality. There it is. So you did it. You made the big step. You made the transition. And then you started the surrogacy journey and you found your wonderful, amazing. I call surrogates unicorns because I think they are these magical, amazing beings who they are really special people. That's I really revere a surrogate. And I have given birth to one of my kids and I would never do that again. Never. So it's, you know, it's a beautiful gift. So you found your surrogate and it sounds like things were pretty smooth for you for the process.
How did you feel before going into it all? You know, you had your concerns.
Surrogacy was the only way that we had there's only option we had, right? So that's the route that we went down. Obviously, Jake had the, you know, the genetic link as part of that process. And so had a, you know, I think emotionally you were right there. I think for me, I went through a process of really worrying about, was I going to be good enough? My thought process was, look, being trans, my body made this sort of hiccup at the start of my life, somewhere along the lines. I don't know where that hiccup goes. And I don't have any of the hormones. Am I going to have a mothering instinct? You know, am I going to bond with the child? Like if you go to the hospital, like where babies are born, all around it is around why skin, you know, those first moments, skin to skin. Hormone,
breastfeeding,
yeah. All these things are so important. They all tell you like, that's how you bond with your baby. And I'm thinking, well, I can't do those things. Does that mean I'm not going to be able to bond with my child? And so I had a lot of nerves going into that process. And then practically when you're in like the clinics and stuff, not intentionally and not in any bad way, but the clinicians would talk to Laura because she was the one that was going through the pregnancy. And they would talk to Jake because it was Jake's, you know, embryo. And I was sometimes felt like I was a little bit like a third wheel there. Mm. And so I felt a little bit emotionally left out. Again, no, not intentionally, not in any really bad way, but like just at a, like an underlying level that just sat with me through the process. So I had a lot of nerves and worry going through it.
Yeah.
But then, oh, I won't jump to what happened when she was born. But yeah, that I had the pregnancy journey for me was a little bit emotional up and down, I guess.
I mean, luckily, like in our last month of the pregnancy, the pandemic started. So that really made things a lot easier for everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, she was in Belfast. We had a little baby moon in Miami. And this was 2 months before she was due. And so, you know, and she had always said, you know, I've always gone to term. Don't worry. 8 weeks is fine. And, you know, we're in Miami and everyone's masking up. And we were like, oh, my God, what is going on? And, you know, at the beginning, no one really understood what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being in the States as well, it was weird. Like, people weren't wearing masks, particularly in Miami. But then, you know, you'd go into the shop and there wouldn't be a single hand gel on any of the shelves. So there was this kind of... how worried are we? How worried should we be? So obviously we bolted back. We got back on the last plane before Trump stopped planes going back to the UK. Oh. So that was like first. And then they, within days, Boris Johnson said that he was about to implement a travel ban. And so we knew we had to get to Belfast by hook or by crook.
Yeah.
And literally just threw everything into Hannah's car and drove, I think, 12 hours overnight.
We went to an Airbnb there and then for like a month.
Yeah.
Before they closed Airbnbs. Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
It was just literally everything was closing down. The ferry was closing down. We got one of the last ferries. Airbnb was closing down. We got one of the last bookings. I mean, it was really like...
And you have to be there. Like,
yeah. I mean, we had to for so many different reasons, but we had to be there, of course, to be the first people to, not to hold her necessarily, but, you know, just to be there so that Laura, A, wouldn't have to look after our baby because
right.
She didn't want that. We didn't want that. But there was also the added pressure that if we caught COVID, she had already been told that social services wouldn't let us take the baby because it was so new. It was so, people were terrified. You know, we were wiping our shopping. There was this whole heightened, we were away from our families because we couldn't be with them or bubble elderly parents. And even thinking about it now, it was on every side.
It was
so
paranoid.
Yeah,
we would go to the shop and literally disinfect every single item that we bought
because
the stakes were so high. Get COVID, don't get, not there for your child for the first days of their birth.
Like, yeah, because it could have been weeks, you know. And again, also people were at that point dying and we didn't know. We didn't know. None of us knew. And so we thought, my God, you know, what if Laura caught it? What if we caught it? You know, as I say, the sort of level of hysteria that we were fighting down the whole way through that last month as we sat in this Airbnb in Belfast, away from our family, away from everyone, not being able to see Laura. You know, we'd had all these plans. We're going to take you out for dinners. We're going to be there with your kids. We're going to... All of that went away. We had plans to be in the room with her during delivery. I have to say, I'm so, so grateful that I was not in that room. But at the time, we thought, yeah, great idea. And then obviously, you know, we weren't allowed to be in the room. She was going to have to be on her own.
Mm.
Everything changed.
Yeah.
She would be the first person to hold. She would be the first person to do skin to skin. You know, we weren't even really allowed to see Millie. She was born at 5:30 and they only let us into the room at about 9:30 in the morning.
Oh, wow.
And that was obviously gloved and everything else. And so crazy.
Crazy. That puts a big hiccup in it, a big one. And I do want to speak to what you were saying earlier, Hannah, about like your fears surrounding skin to skin and the breastfeeding and the narrative that is really told about that maternal instinct. I really think it's a harmful narrative and I really think we need to stop because I don't have the layers that you had going into this, Hannah. However, I had a really hard time breastfeeding. I did not bond with either children right away. And I was non-bio mom to the first one. And then, so I thought it was just because of my non-bio connection that I didn't bond with her. It took a while. I'm a slow burn, apparently, with the connecting with the child. But when I gave birth to the second one, I didn't connect with him right away either. So they feed us this like false narrative of what mothering and nurturing is that I think really sets us up for failure. I felt like such a failure as a mother because none of the stuff that was supposed to happen actually happened the way it was supposed to.
Yeah, I entirely agree. And I don't think it's just for queer parents. I think that, you know, there's so many people who go through this experience. And I just think we could just be a bit more careful about the way it's communicated. Like, I'm not saying that it's not a good thing to say, look, you know, these are the benefits of breastfeeding.
Right.
But making it out like if you don't breastfeed, it's a failure.
Right.
Is a miscommunication which harms people. So yeah. There's got to be a finer balance with that approach.
Yeah, yeah, it's not fair. And then, like, Jose, in your instance, you can't breastfeed. There's no breastfeeding happening. You know, you're two dads, so.
It's true. We weren't hormonal. And, yeah, it's interesting with, you know, calling surrogates unicorns. I mean, our surrogate ended up, like, shipping us breast milk for 6 months for all three of the kids. You know,
they're it's amazing. Like,
what? That wasn't even part of the contract. And I think as a father, I was worried about, you know, with what society tells you, I'm like, oh my God, I don't have motherly instinct and I'm not going to be able to, you know, figure this out, especially when I became a single dad of all three of my kids. And, you know, I need to make sure I have as many females around. And the reality is, like, yes, motherly instinct is a real thing. I do think that women get the societal pressure that men don't get. And I think that's unfortunate. And I talk about that a lot. Yeah, I can't even imagine being in your position at that time during COVID, dealing with all the things that people would normally deal with. It's like, I'm more curious about what was that first time like to see your baby? Was there a connection? Was there not a connection?
We were sitting in this Airbnb knowing that we weren't going to get in, and we'd been told that we were going to have to wait in the car park. And so we were still 15 minutes down the road of the Airbnb. And then we got photos coming through from Laura, who was eventually allowed a birthing partner, her best friend, who was sending us these photos of Millie covered in blood, held aloft, screaming, you know, sort of, I have to say, a little bit horrified. Hannah went, she's here. And I went, oh, great. And I don't know what I expected when Hannah went, she's here.
It was that photo that made you realize, I'm glad I wasn't in the delivery room.
Oh, my God. You have no idea. Honestly, I saw that and I thought, oh, my God, thank someone for not putting me in that room. But I thought, you know, we were going to see this beautiful little baby swaddled. It was not that at all. It was gore fest. And she'd had to have a C-section because apparently what I didn't realize and what I learned actually through that process is that there is usually the fetus sends a message to but you know, the person carrying them to deliver the baby. And apparently, according to the doctor, my fetus was not, because of the different DNA sending those signals to Laura's womb. And so the baby wasn't coming out. They induced, nothing was happening. And so her sac had popped, there was no water. And eventually they had to do C-section and they had to do that with both babies. And it wasn't nice for her at all. But this was just something that apparently is like a genetic thing that either does or doesn't happen. And so when we finally got to the hospital and finally they let us in four and a half hours later, and we were the first surrogacy they'd ever seen at this very, you know, Irish small town hospital. Not only the only trans couple. So, you know, that we were a bit like, and amongst all the pandemic and, you know, bits taped off, and, you know, it looked like, honestly, like a zombie movie with all the tape and all the like dark corridors. And we were kind of like, almost like rock stars when we walked in, and they were like, oh my God, and it's them, and it's the, and a lot of people were talking about us. And so we had our own little special room, which again was a COVID thing, but it was great because we had our own room and we sat there and Laura was wheeled in holding Millie. And honestly, it still now, like, the absolute disbelief that we had a baby. I was like, oh my God, that's our baby. That's our baby. And, you know, she was covered in blood and smelt of blood and, you know, but was our little baby. And we held her. Laura gave her to us and we both held her. And it was just honestly something I never, ever, ever thought would happen to me. That I was a dad and, you know, that Hannah was a mum. And, you know, we just sat, Laura eventually was like, I've got to go and lie down, you know, as in rest. So she went off to her private room, which was nice. Mm-hmm. And the nurses were lovely. And, you know, as I say, there wasn't a lot to do because there were so few births happening at that point. But, you know, they brought us food and they looked after us and they showed us how to bathe her and feed her and everything else. And it was magic.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I mean, it was amazing. I think I don't think I had an immediate, like, really strong emotional connection. I found it amazing, beautiful, wonderful. Like, the first time that, you know, Millie laid on me and just, I felt her warmth in her heartbeat. And she was like, when she was on Jake, she was hiccuping, you know. And that, so like, I found it very beautiful, but I wouldn't have said that was a point where I found my deep connection with her. I'd say that came about 2 weeks later, and it was, you know, you're in the thick of, you know, just keeping them alive and, you know, feeding
so every, hard,
you know, every sort of whatever it was, every hour or 2 hours,
and every couple of hours.
Our surrogate, like yours, Jose, was very great at giving us like breast milk. But Millie, at the very start, we'd used bottle milk and
formula,
and therefore, for whatever reason, didn't take to the breast milk. So we went back to the bottles, which meant that everything was like not warm enough for her. So like she would cry, and then you would have to spend like one hand here holding, shaking, whilst one hand like hot water here. So it wasn't as quick and easy as it was maybe if you were breastfeeding. But I remember Jake was sleeping in the middle of the night. It was probably about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was doing my shift because we had a bit of a shift thing going. I remember in that moment when I was holding her and feeding her, and it was just, I thought like right now it's just me and you. Like there's no one else here. Like I'm your everything. If I get this wrong, it goes wrong. And I knew, I was like, well, I'm never going to let that happen to you. And that was a kind of like, that was like a little click, because I've realized that I was her, in that moment, I was her everything and she was mine. And that was the connection.
Hannah, I love that you share that story, because that's exactly like what I had felt. Tim was away somewhere and I had to go up and change Avery. And at this point, I'm still kind of like in my feelings about the whole situation. And it was, I went to change him, and the way sort of like the light was coming in the bedroom, and I like had him in my arms, and the way he was looking up at me, it was just this moment of like, oh, he was like, I need you. You're my person in this moment. And I was like, and I just lost it and realized, I'm like, oh, and that's exactly what it was for me. It was a moment so similar. And yeah, that's such a beautiful place to be. And not everybody gets there. And so, right, you know, it's really incredible that you were able to get there. I was able to get there. And again, just to show that biology doesn't, you know, often play a role on the magnitude of love you can have for your own child.
And it just sneaks up on you, right? It just happens. Like, it's not like the moment can feel like a bit of an epiphany, but it's just like, it's just in the mundane. Like, it's just in the middle of the night where you're multitasking, balancing, thinking about the time and like where the milk is, like kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, it's just like, it hits you.
And there it is. Yeah. And that's why our stories need to be told more. We flip the narrative. We flip the narrative and we shine a light on the universal truths about love and family. And what makes a real family? Like we prove so much just by showing up in the world. And that's why I love us so much. And then I know you have to go and I want to get you out, but another.
No. Honestly, we're fine.
Another baby came. There's another baby. Come. Yeah.
I know. I just want to talk about what happened in the middle though.
What happened in the middle? Oh, I mean, yeah. So, you know, Laura was fantastic. You know, again, even after she was born and we were there, we couldn't go and see Laura because, you know, again, it was height of. So it was the only time we saw Laura, Joe, that whole thing was for an hour in the hospital. It was just, the whole thing was so bizarre. This amazing woman who had carried our baby, who of course we were in touch with daily, but, you know, we weren't able to see her or be near her. And so, you know, we had just left Ireland. You know, it took us 10 days to register Millie's birth because nowhere was registering births because everyone was just overcome with deaths. So literally it took us about 10 days just to get someone in Ireland who would register her.
Wow.
And then we spoke to the airline because there was no travel. And so we spoke to the airline and they gave us a space on an airline, an Aer Lingus, you know, and they gave us a row with no one around so that we could take our baby home safely. And then we got back to our little house and again, couldn't see family, couldn't see friends, couldn't see anyone. And, you know, just us and our little baby, which again was absolute joy and heaven and miraculous, but also terrifying because mm-hmm. we had no one to kind of lean on. And then literally Laura, about like 2 weeks after Millie was born, called us and was like, "Sir, that was the best experience of my life. I'm ready to go again. Would you like to?" And we were like, "Oh." I was like, I mean, I still want to do another one now, you know, but at the time I was like, yes, absolutely. And so she said, "Well, look, as soon as I heal, let's give it a year. And then let's give it another go." And we honestly, that was sort of what we thought about for the next, you know, obviously whilst having a baby and pandemic and everything else. And then we gave it another go and she got pregnant again. And sadly, that was an ectopic pregnancy.
Oh.
But again, she was like, you know what? I'm fine. She, you know, she said, give me a few months. And once again, you know, we were all kind of there for all the scans and everything else. And that was obviously a blow. But then we gave it the third attempt, and lo and behold, she got pregnant again. I mean, this woman, she said to us, she was like the most fertile person she knew. She got pregnant with her first child whilst on the coil and her second child whilst on the pill. Wow. And she was like, honestly, I've got this covered. Don't worry. and that was it. And then we had our beautiful little Teddy, and you know, we are absolutely the luckiest people in the world. Mm. I cannot say that if she didn't come to us now and say, would you like to go again, that I wouldn't leap at the chance, because I would love another baby. And also, we're kind of in a part of London where it's like, they call it Nappy Valley, because there are so many kids around here and all our friends have got babies. And so I'm like, oh, baby. I'm the weird dad now who's like, can I touch your baby? Yeah. And you know, all the moms are kind of like, oh God, Jake again. Yes, we know you want another child. Hannah's told everyone.
Oh my God.
You know, we're kind of, and we speak to her, and you know, we can only, I would kill for another one.
Oh my gosh.
I'm less convinced. I feel like our family is complete. And
what is a complete family, really? You know, when you go,
I'm not here to discourage.
I mean, Jose has three.
As a father of three, I think two is very sweet.
But let's talk more about being a father of three, and how is that for you? And
you know, when you're crossing the street and you have more, you know, less hands to hold than you know, that's where it gets like really complicated. You know, it's interesting. Having three kids 15 months and under was like a literal shit show. but I absolutely, as they've gotten older, I mean, just the fact that they're all close in age, I do love it. But yeah, three's a lot.
Three's a lot.
It would be wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
But can we tell you guys also, we're happy to talk for, you know, another 20 minutes or whatever. Are we allowed to tell you a little bit about our first
kid's
book? Yes,
I was going to ask you about it, because I saw that you have it. So yeah, please do, because it looks like a beautiful book and we all need to go buy it for our shelves. Like, let's go.
This is it. So this is The Silly Frilly Dress, and it's co-written by Hannah and I, and illustrated by a fantastic woman called Lucia Sotto. I mean, if you just look at some of the illustrations, you know, it is... just beautiful. There's little Sunny. This is a young person who, you know, you're kind of assuming is basically my story. I mean, look at all that. And it's my story. And it's about a little assigned female at birth person called Sunny. But this is like an agenda-free book. It is just about a little person who doesn't want to wear a dress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my story growing up was just that. You know, I grew up in a household which was very kind of conservative, and my parents didn't have a lot of LGBT friends. You know, I knew who I was from a very young age. It wasn't because of YouTube. It wasn't because of, you know, anything else, any external influence other than I was who I was. And, you know, my parents were great. My mother now is my biggest champion. But at the time I was like, I don't want to wear a dress. And this was every Christmas and birthday and holiday. And I began as a little kid to dread Christmas in a weird way, because I knew that would be, you know, being put in a dress. And, you know, as a small person, having those moments ruined because it meant, you know, the humiliation, which it was to me, humiliation of being put into a dress. I would not want any other little kid to feel like that. And, you know, we are so into our gender roles and rules of, you know, girls pink and boys blue, and girls must wear dresses and look pretty, and boys must be strapping and big and play football. And, you know, this is what we, I think, as a society should be trying to push away from. You know, interestingly, when we've read this to our daughters, you know, so I keep putting it in front of your face, when I've read this to our daughters, because our two, they are the girliest girls in the world.
When
Millie and Teddy read it, Millie's like, I don't get it. Why doesn't she want to wear a dress? What's wrong with her? And literally, you know, off she goes to put on her pinkest, unicorniest, rainbowest. But, you know, there are so many little kids. And obviously, I'd like it to appeal to trans kids as well, trans boys. But we know that we are in the minority. We know that there are so many little girls who might turn out queer, who might turn out gender nonconforming, who hopefully this book will make feel a little less alone. And that for us would be job done and would be our dream.
I'll tell you what, my daughter's 12, and she was a little girl who hated dresses, hated them. We just couldn't get her to wear them. She's right here. She's making fun of me right now. But this book would have been great for her too. And now she, and now she's 12 and all of a sudden she started wearing skirts. It's a really weird thing has happened.
Really?
Yes. A really weird thing has happened.
Well, I saw her recently and she looked amazing in her dress.
Dress.
Now, I don't think my daughter, Lila, I have twin girls, London and Lila.
Oh, wow.
By the way, London comes from where my late husband proposed on the London Eye Ferris wheel.
So, oh, my God, that's beautiful. So,
cleared out a capsule and everything.
Wow.
Yeah. So her name's London Rose. It's a tribute to him. My daughter, Lila, again, has not worn a dress since she was 3, and she's 12, will be 12 in a few weeks, and she will never wear a dress.
I don't see Lila ever wearing a dress ever.
And that's what I love about both of them. One is like your daughter, like, you know, one, a very girly girl. She farts glitter. Like she just, like, you know, I have to yell at her for not walking down the stairs wearing makeup. And then the other one is not interested. Blue's her favorite color. And, you know, she's a sports girl and, you know, we'll see where she identifies, right, in the future, but a book like that would have been magical. And I'm excited to promote it and purchase it and show her, because even at 12 years old, she can read that book and totally appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we know that obviously it is available for US audiences. What was it? Did they say Blackwell's?
Blackwell's.
I don't know if that's apparently it's available on Blackwell's. And you know what? Our dream. The problem is that this should not be perceived as a contentious book. There is no agenda. There is no label. There is no nothing. It's literally a book for little people who don't want to wear a dress. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, our absolute dream would be to get onto the banned books list so that we can just say, you know what? We got onto the band's book list. So if there's any way to, you know, make out that this is a lot more contentious than it is, just so that we can get onto that list, that's the dream.
All right. Let's work on it. And
I was going to say, don't threaten me with a good time.
Yeah. This podcast is full of parents of young kids or potential, like soon to be parents. And they're going to fill this, their shelf with this book. This is going to be one of the books on their shelves. And I'm a huge fan of reading. I teach through books with my kids. Like, so they learned about our families through books. They learned about how babies are made through children's books, you know? So I'm a huge, huge fan of that. So everybody go buy the book, go get the book. And then the more people who buy it, the more likely it is that the far right is going to see it and want to ban it. So come on, we know our job. It's the gay agenda. Let's go. Let's go.
It's so nice how they just curate these lists of like wonderful books that we want to buy by banning them.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that would be fantastic. So thank you so much for that little plug.
Yeah, of course. And a link to it will be in the show notes. So everybody can just click the link.
Thank you.
Yeah, this has been just so fabulous talking to you too and getting to know you. I'm so glad you agreed to come on the show. Thank you.
It's been absolutely lovely. I have to say it's 10 past 9 in the UK. Oh. And we've been doing interviews and TV all day and things. But this has been, I have to say, an absolute highlight of the day. And I mean that absolutely genuinely. So thank you both so much.
Oh my God. Thank you. But I love you too. Thank you so much, Jose. Thank you for co-hosting with me.
Oh my gosh, of course. This was magical.
Yeah. And please keep in touch. You're a member of the family now. So members of the family. So I need to hear.
Thank you so much for having us on. It's been lovely.
Queer Family Podcast.
A huge, huge thank you to our sponsor of this here episode, California Cryo Bank. Don't forget to use code QueerFam26 to get that free level 3 subscription to their donor catalog. Go make those babies, y'all, and then come tell me about them. Let's do this.
Love is love.
Whew. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, feel free to listen to another or watch another. I have so many episodes for your listening or viewing pleasure. Just go pick one and enjoy. There's a lot. There really is. And also, if you really do like this show, please, I know I say it all the time, but please do consider supporting the show on Patreon. You're just going to go to patreon.com/thequeerfamilypodcast. You're going to pick a tier, you're going to join, and you're going to get that bonus content. And you're also going to get my love and adoration for the rest of my life. I love you all. Thanks for tuning in. Keep on tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Mwah.